Network exec. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Richard Gere, has starred in such films as Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Days of Heaven, American Gigolo, An Officer and a Gentleman, Pretty Woman, Unfaithful, and Chicago. His new film, The Hoax, is based on the true story of an infamous publishing hoax. In 1971, the writer Clifford Irving claimed to have gotten permission from the reclusive and eccentric mogul Howard Hughes to become Hughes's authorized biographer. Irving negotiated a six-figure advance from his publisher and eventually handed in a manuscript he said was based on interviews with Hughes. But Irving never had any contact with Hughes. None. How Irving managed to write the book and pass it off to his publisher as the real thing, getting deeper and deeper into his lies, is the subject of The Hoax. In this scene, Clifford Irving is discussing the scam with his friend and collaborator, who is skeptical they'll get away with it. The friend is played by Alfred Molina.
A man walks in, he says something completely implausible, and for that exact reason, he's believed. No, it's an Aquarian phenomenon. Very, very spiritual.
Lawyers are not spiritual. Presumably this is going to make news. Howard Hughes hasn't spoken to the press in 15 years.
What are you so nervous about? You can't think, Dick. No thinking.
All I'm saying is, once this gets out, what's going to stop this guy from suing our asses off? Have you heard of Innertel? He has his own private CIA. Ruthless advisors.
His advisors don't know anything about the book because he's too paranoid to tell them. And he'll never come out of hiding long enough to denounce me because he's a lunatic hermit. And I am the spokesperson for the lunatic hermit. So the more outrageous I sound, the more convincing I am.
I talk with Richard Gere about his impressions of Clifford Irving, who Gere portrays in The Hoax.
If you read his fake autobiography, which is probably the best thing he's ever written, it's really quite beautiful and quite touching. And it starts off with an answer to a question. And the question is, why would Howard Hughes ask me to do this, of all the writers in the world? And he goes into an evaluation of his own writing. He calls himself a journeyman writer, and he goes into his background. And it is really kind of beautiful writing. And he finds this psychological, emotional, spiritual kinship with Howard Hughes as only children and young men who had lost their fathers when they were teenagers. And there was a kind of mental, emotional, aesthetic points of view that they had in common. And much of that I took in the work that I did on the movie.
So Clifford Irving is still alive. Did you want to talk with him?
I didn't when we were shooting. And it was a very conscious decision that you know, we were not making a documentary about him. And he's clearly, I make the assumption that he's a very manipulative guy. And frankly, I just didn't want to be in a position to be concerned about his feelings about this. Nor did I want his point of view, really. I had a very clear point of view from the script and all the research material. And I had enormous respect for him, you know, and really came to like him, actually. Very fond of him, the character that I knew. But I really didn't want that influence. In fact, I just talked to him about 10 days ago for the first time.
Why did you talk to him?
Well, I felt it was time. Uh-huh. You know, the movie's finished, and it felt like the right thing to do.
Had he seen
this
it?
Was, yeah.
What did he have to say about it?
You can imagine a bunch of strangers making a movie about you. Now, do you think they're going to get it all right? Highly unlikely. So he was very sensitive with me on the phone about this, but I know there's stuff that he had problems with. And I assured him, I said, look, Clifford, this is not a documentary. And obviously you've seen the movie, so we're after, in some ways, much larger game than just the story of this aspect of your life. We're going after Nixon. We're going after Watergate. We're going after the Vietnam War. We're going after a lot of things with this movie.
I'd like to talk about your movie career with you, starting from your pre-movie career when you got the leading role of Danny Zuko in the London production of Grease. And I find it so interesting that you started in a musical and you were in Chicago, which is like such a great film. And that was really recently. So many years later, you were in a musical again. Did you ever intend or expect your career to start with a musical?
Well, it didn't really. I mean, I left college when I was, it was after my sophomore year, and I had auditioned and received an offer to be at the Provincetown Playhouse in Cape Cod. And I left school to do that, and one thing led to another, and I was then in the Seattle Repertory Theater for a season, and then I left that, and I had a rock band for a little while, and then I decided I was going to go become an actor. And I came to New York, and it was an interesting time. It was the late 60s. It was about this time, 1970 maybe, when I came to New York. And I had long hair, and I had I could sing and dance and play guitars and keyboards and things, and rock musicals were happening. And the first audition I did was a rock musical. It wasn't Grease. It was another show called Soon. And I got that job, and that kept me floating for a while. And I think there was another musical after that about Richard Farina that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of other plays, and then the Grease job came up, which I really enjoyed. I was an understudy in New York. I covered like five or six parts. And then had this offer to go to open it in London, which was a big move for me. You know, for a young actor to go to the West End and in a very successful show there was a great growing, expanding experience for me, no doubt about it.
So when you were in Chicago a couple of years ago in the movie adaptation mm-hmm. of the musical,
I have forgotten how much fun it was, to tell you the truth.
How much fun a musical is?
Oh, yeah. It had been 30 years since I did a musical,
mm-hmm.
and I had really forgotten just how much fun, especially good material with, you know, a terrific script. Bill Condon wrote that script mm-hmm. for Chicago, and Rob Marshall, of course, the director. It was just about the most fun I've ever had as an actor.
Had you been singing, like, at home in the intervening years, or did you feel like you had to brush up with singing lessons?
No, music has been a full-time part of my life, my whole life. So that's always there. But we had a wonderful vocal coach on that we all came from different traditions. Catherine Zeta-Jones is got an incredible voice, but she is not necessarily a Broadway kind of voice. Mine is not a Broadway kind of voice. It's more of a rock voice. So we all were taking training to sing this kind of stuff.
What did you learn about your voice through that training?
Well, I learned how to not strain it so much, actually. I learned how to get off of it a little bit, which, in fact, has made it stronger.
Well, while we're talking about Chicago, why don't we hear you performing in the role from the soundtrack? And I thought we'd play All I Care About. And we should say here that you're a lawyer who really is in it for, like, the money and the fame, and you're singing about how all you really care about is love. Here it is, Richard Gere from the soundtrack.
I don't care about expensive things. Cashmere coats, diamond rings, don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. That's what I'm here for. I don't care for wearing silk cravats, ruby studs, satin spats, don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. Give me two eyes of blue, softly saying, let me see her standing there, and honest mister, I'm a millionaire. I don't care for any fine attire, Vanderbilt might admire, no, no, not me. All I care about is love.
I want to ask you about American Gigolo, which was written and directed by Paul Schrader. And you play a very high-class escort in this who's hired by mostly wealthy older women.
The word now is a sex worker.
Yes.
That's
thank you.
That's the international term.
Yes, and you're often hired by older women who are visiting and who either want a thrill or just want to be desired. Particularly desired by somebody who's really attractive. Let me just play.
Beyond that, even if you really look at the root of it, it's just treated
yeah.
well.
Uh huh.
Someone
uh-huh.
they just want to be treated well. Someone uh-huh. to notice them.
Let me play a short scene. This is a scene from early on where you're in, it's like a restaurant or a hotel bar, and you're glancing at an older woman played by, slightly older woman, played by Lauren Hutton. You think she wants to hire you, and she's doesn't realize you're a pro, and she's flattered by your attention. So here's the scene from American Gigolo.
Why did you come on to me?
Like I said, I made a mistake. I heard you speaking French. Often in these big hotels, you run into women from foreign countries who may need a translator or a guide.
And they hire you?
Yes.
How many languages do you speak?
Five or six.
Plus the international language.
That's right.
So that's Lauren Hutton and my guest Richard Gere in a scene from American Gigolo. Did you realize when you made this scene the ways in which it was going to resonate culturally? And I think one of the ways it resonated culturally was just in terms of, I think the most iconic scene in the movie is like when you're taking your clothes out of the closet and of the drawers and you're laying them out on the bed.
That was so far beyond me. First of all, I don't think I even owned a suit at that point. And this was all Paul Schrader.
Mm-hmm.
Paul had this thing about, I think he called it the new dandyism. And he was very prescient about this. It was Giorgio...
Moroder.
Giorgio
Armani. Giorgio Moroder did the music. And
he did the
Giorgio,
music. Well, I just also
Giorgio
just
Armani
saw
did the
last
clothes.
Week also, yeah. And I haven't seen him since then.
Armani but, or Moroder?
Moroder.
Uh-huh.
And so Armani, it was very stylized clothes. And I mean, this whole thing about shirts and picking out a tie that went with the shirt and
uh-huh.
the thing and all... I mean, this was a total construct. I didn't know anything about this, but I went with it and I said, okay, let's give this a try.
It's funny that the movie didn't become famous as like a crime story. It became famous.
No, it's about style.
Yes, yeah,
you know,
so exactly. It became famous for style. Yeah.
But that's what it was, really.
Mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
really was about two-dimensional realities, magazine realities,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a kind of tendency, especially in the West. To see things in surfaces.
Now, had you seen Taxi Driver, which Paul Schrader wrote before you made
sure.
American Gigolo?
Of course.
They seem to come from such like different places in his mind. But did Taxi Driver help you in any way in understanding where he was coming from?
Well, he had already done his own movie, Blue Collar, I believe, at that point,
mm-hmm.
which he wrote and directed. But Paul was... I mean, it's enough known, you could see where the guy was coming from, that he wanted to do some adventurous work and stylish work, you know. Even as rough as Taxi Driver was, as gritty, it's very stylish. Its use of music, its use of visuals, its cutting style, it's very stylish. It has a very visceral, gritty energy to it. But, you know, Paul's a classicist and a great structuralist. There's probably no one better in the business at structuring a story in an interesting way than Paul Schrader.
You know, you said that he saw this movie as being about the new dandy. And there's a scene early on where you're working out, hanging upside down from your ankles while lifting hand weights. And I think it's like one of the early times in a movie when somebody's working out for kind of glamour abs as opposed to because, like, they're a tough guy or they're a weightlifter or something.
Yeah, those boots. I haven't seen them since then. But, yeah, I mean, this was Paul's idea, which, was way ahead of its time, of people being sucked into two-dimensional surface realities.
Mm-hmm.
With the body, with the clothes, with the hair, with the right sunglasses, with the walk, with the... It's all about presentation without substance. So you see this guy systematically being stripped of all style, all surface, and ends up in jail, leaning up against a glass window where he touches the girl through the window. They put hands up against glass. It's someone who has to start from ground zero and actually build a human being now instead of a Cupid doll.
I'm so glad that you describe this as being a movie about people who are sucked up in two-dimensional realities, because that kind of answers the question that I was going to ask you. You know, most people know that you've been, practicing and studying Buddhism for many years. And, of course, you know, the kind of, narcissism and materialistic culture that the character in American Gigolo represents is exactly what Buddhism is about not doing. It's about kind of transcending.
I'm thinking of a scene in the movie that actually is the opposite of that. And you can't play these things and be, you can't be two-dimensional playing a two-dimensional person. You have to be three, you have to show the possibility of three plus dimensions and that it's been squeezed into two in the story. But there's a scene in there, as I recall, where he's surfacing a woman, and I think her husband has paid me to do this, and he wants to watch. And she's very, she's nauseated by this. And if I'm remembering the scene, I just tell her it's all right. Just relax and forget about him. And I was just very nice with her, very gentle and, in his way, sensitive with her. And within his own structure, he's a mensch. Now, in terms of the world and what's legal and what isn't, he's a bad guy. But within what he does, he is there to provide a service in a very real way and takes it very seriously. And those are real human moments in the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you already interested in Buddhism then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been practicing since my early 20s.
You know, I know that you know the Dalai Lama, and he's pretty famous for different reasons, of course, but you've had to learn how to deal with fame. I wonder if watching him and how he deals with his own kind of fame has been interesting and valuable for you.
It's had an enormous impact on me. I don't know any actor or artist or anyone else who, by inclination, wants the negative side of being famous. The lack of privacy, the sense of being in a fishbowl. Nobody wants that. And I see His Holiness go through that his whole life, since he was 2 years old and he was discovered. And the incredible patience and grace that he deals with that was enormously instructive to me. That every interaction was a possibility for compassion, for love, for transformation.
I read that you were banned as an Academy Award presenter back in around 1993, while presenting an award, you used it as an opportunity to condemn the Chinese government for the occupation of Tibet.
It was slightly different than that.
Yeah, explain what happened, because I just read about it.
I wasn't condemning. I mean, I certainly told the truth, but my approach is not... I'm inclusive. Any system that is exclusive is doomed to failure. So my whole thing with the Chinese is that for them to do the right thing is good for them. For them to do the wrong thing is bad for them. Forgetting everyone else. If you have any concern for the Chinese, they're creating a horrendous future for themselves by being not compassionate and being bad in the present. So my approach with them is really just to encourage them to be the best government, the best people that they can be, and to treat everyone else like brothers and sisters.
But anyways, you use the Academy Awards as an opportunity to say something
about
China. Were you warned beforehand not to do that, or did they explain why they banned you afterwards?
I don't know why. I mean, obviously I spoke, and the powers that be were not pleased, which was okay with me.
Was the orchestra trying to play you off as you spoke?
No. No, I don't think they were. I think I went into some slightly mad monologue about something similar to what I just said. And then I presented some award. I even forget what it is now, what it was. But it was, there are 6 million Tibetans inside of Tibet. There's about 150,000 Tibetans who've gotten out, and they need our help.
And just one more thing on this. Did you get a letter saying, "Dear Richard Gere, you'll never again present on this stage"? how did they let you know?
No, they told my agent. They said, "He will never, ever, ever be on this stage again." So,
I want to get back to, you know, some of your films. I read that when you were young, you loved the Hercules films, and, you know, like the Samson and Delilah kind of stuff, where there's like this strong man.
I did. I always loved that, and I don't know exactly why. I think it was just because it was myth.
Mm-hmm.
The power
mm-hmm.
of myth. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't about words. It was about, who was the
Steve Reeves?
Gustave Moreau.
Sorry.
Is he the great engravist? It is Gustave Moreau, I believe, who did wonderful, epic engravings. And there was something about that touched me. I think probably still does. I like to see just kind of mythic representations of what we are and maybe who we really are.
I was thinking about the distance between that myth, like the Hercules myth, and the kind of mythic representation in, say, Pretty Woman, which is this like romance myth, you know, of like, mm-hmm. you know, the hooker and the tycoon who are both kind of in the same business in some way, but they find this kind of good essence within each other and have plenty of money, and when they hook up, it's such a different kind of myth than the Hercules one. Did you feel like you could connect with that one, with the romance myth?
I wasn't a believer myself when that movie came up, and I didn't get it at all. And the reality was, someone who I did respect basically talked me into looking at it over and over again. And I still didn't get it until I met Gary Marshall, who directed it. And Gary's an especially good heart. And there is something truly delightful and wonderful about Gary. And Gary, you know, we didn't even talk about the movie that much, but I had a feeling that Gary's heart was going to end up on screen. And there's a real truth to him. I mean, it's not about the money. It's not about the jobs. It's about two people being, in the end, fundamentally honest with themselves and each other about who they are. And they weren't cool. You know, when we're not cool is when people fall in love with us, correct? When we're just ourselves and we're a bit goofy and...
This is what we really hope anyways.
Well, it's always true in my life. Uh-huh, you know, every uh-huh. time that the stuff, the idea of us is dropped, the idea of you and me is dropped, then there's the possibility of really seeing what's there. And usually there's just a human being and there's something delightful and what's the word?
Vulnerable.
Yeah, for sure, vulnerable. But it's nutritious mm-hmm. to the soul. It's nutritious to our hearts to see a human being.
So you did this movie without believing in it?
Well, once you get into something, of course, you make it that. And we worked very hard to, within the structure of what it was and in the style that it was, to find a human truth there. Again, the style is a very romantic style. This is not a gritty movie. You know, she's not a gritty hooker. You know, this is a Disney hooker.
Mm-hmm. So after you made this movie that you didn't quite get, did everybody want to cast you in their version of that same kind of movie that you wouldn't quite get?
Well, I think everyone tried to make that movie. Everyone thought it was easy. You know, people think that kind of a movie is easy, and it's not. It's lightning in a bottle. And, you know, everyone tried to make basically the same movie, and I think they all failed.
No,
we even tried to make a movie after that, Julie and I, which wasn't nearly as good.
Which one was that?
Runaway Bride.
Oh, right, sure. Now, An Officer and a Gentleman, another movie that kind of struck some kind of chord, particularly because of that last scene where you walk into the place where Deborah Winger's working, and you literally like pick her up and sweep her off the feet, and everybody applauds, and it's like, how many times is that going to happen in real life?
I remember, but
it struck this chord, yeah.
Well, there was Bernardo Bertolucci was a friend of mine then, and we were talking about doing another movie, and he said he'd seen Officer and Gentleman. He said, I like the movie very much, but the ending is very fascist. And I kind of let it go, and then he said something else like that. And I went, wait a minute, what do you mean, fascist? He said, well, you know, when the army comes in the factory and the workers applaud. So there was an element of that. I never thought it would work, and I cautioned the director. Said, "Let's we don't have much money. Let's cut this scene and shoot something else that we know is going to be in the movie." And he said, "I know it's probably not, but let's shoot it anyway." And so we did it full out, and everyone, you know, filled it with the emotions that were required. And I still was kind of skeptical, although it was a gas shooting it. You know, it was kind of a rush shooting the scene, coming into this factory of women workers. And, you know, I had that vanilla ice cream naval suit on and picked her up like Sir Galahad. And I never thought it would work. And frankly, it wasn't working great until Taylor got the right music under it. And then he found the right rhythm, the perfect rhythm for that music. And it, even for me, it worked.
What was the music? I don't remember what the music was.
It was the theme music of It's Up, Up Where You Belong. It was that music.
Oh.
It was the instrumental version of that.
Oh.
Which had been my theme music for the whole movie. But he found the right tempo that was almost the tempo of a heart beating.
Huh. So do you finally think it works?
Yeah, no, I do. Now, why they work, I'm not sure. It's magic. I don't know. You can't make those things happen.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Enjoyed it.
Richard Gere is starring in the new film, The